Chapter 23.
I clutched the quartz of elderberries against my leather jacket and grinned, knowing how excited Ruth would be that I'd found them in the wintertime. They taste like home to her, like her life's seasons. I could already smell hot elderberry pie. I leaned forward on the subway track and looked down as far as I could see. I was anxious to get home. The sun would be up within hours, Ruth's sewing machine would be humming, wait till she saw the elderberries. Her smile would be my dawn. I heard the three teenage boys before I saw them. They shouted in boisterous camaraderie as they jumped the turnstile, white boys pumped up on chemicals. Their first target was an old man asleep on a bench. They rousted him, kicked him, passed him from one set of brutal hands to another. They laughed as he pushed through the turnstile and ran. That's when I made a mistake. I moved further back into the station, away from them. In doing so, I moved further from the exit or any possibility of help. Some mistakes in life are not punishable. Others teach you a lesson you never forget. When I heard their footsteps growing closer, I knew better than to hide behind the pillar. It's far worse to be caught cowering. I reached inside the bag and pulled out a small handful of elderberries. Their tart taste heightened my senses. They stained my hands with the colour of battles won and lost. I set the rest of the berries down on the platform, wishing Ruth could have known I had found her elderberries in the winter in this paved city. I wanted more time with Ruth. I wish I had thanked her for breathing a little life back into me. I positioned my house keys between my fingers so that my fists bristled with coppery spikes. I was trapped between the end of the station and the three faces getting closer. They are the hunters, I am the prey. For just a moment before it began, I cursed Ruth for making me hope again. Then I let go of everything except the moment confronting me. The leader of the pack emerged. He reached for my face. "What have we here?" he asked, almost gently. I blocked his hand with my own. He smiled. Now I'd begun. My spiked fist was out of their sight. I didn't reveal my readiness. His buddies leered and sneered, but his smile was harder to stand up to. It reminded me of a cop smirk, meant to force me to admit powerlessness. "What the fuck are you?" he asked quietly. "I can't tell what you are. Maybe we should just find out, huh, guys?" His taunts and threats rolled off me, not because I was impervious to them, but because I was filled to overflowing. I tried not to listen. It didn't matter what he said. It didn't matter what I answered. All that was important was the action. The positioning of their bodies and mine, the juxtaposition of matter and space, open throats and unguarded kneecaps. At the instant the action exploded, I would have a moment to strike, to change the relationship of forces. When one of their punches connected with my body, when blood filled my eyes, when I could no longer catch a breath, I would be theirs. I braced myself against the leftover grit of elderberries between my teeth. Any moment it would erupt. Any moment. I looked the leader in his eyes, refusing to show him my fear. Of course we both knew I was afraid. I wasn't ready to die. Oh, I was scared all right. What I hadn't shown him yet was my rage. I'd never get my hands on the power that twisted and unleashed. I was sure as hell going to try to take them with me. I could feel a breeze on my face. A train was approaching. Would it come in time to save me? The attack began at that moment. His body betrayed him. He telegraphed his intention to move. I swung my spiked fist in an uppercut to his chin. At the moment of impact, he bit off the end of his tongue. His blood sprayed my face. More of his blood ran down my wrist as I yanked out my fist. The train roared into the station. Another open throat. I thrust my clenched fist into it as hard as I could. Even over the racket of the train, I could hear the gurgling sound as I pulled out my keys. A fist as hard as an anvil smashed the side of my jaw. The opposite side of my skull slammed into the metal column. I staggered down the platform, rubbing someone else's blood from me. The train doors opened. The early morning rush hour crowd moved away from me in horror. When the doors closed, I looked around. They hadn't followed me onto the train. I looked at my hands, stained with elderberries and blood. I wondered how much of the blood was my own. My head throbbed more and more insistently. A steel rod of pain pierced my jaw, fiery, hot, icy cold. My vision doubled, focused and blurred again. I couldn't hear the sound of the train over the roar in my ears. I got off the train at 14th Street. It was Ruth I wanted to see. If I was going to die, I wanted to be in the arms of someone who understood me, but I knew we risked a hideous scene if we went to the hospital together. Maybe if I went alone and they didn't make me take my t-shirt off, they might help me. No one noticed me at first as I staggered through the double doors of St. Vincent's Hospital. Then hands reached out for me, guided me. A nurse peered in my face as she pushed forms towards me. I invented someone who had insurance and no fear of being traced. How long would it take them to check out my lies? Another nurse laid me down gently. A gale wind blew behind my eyes. Doctors and nurses bent over the table and peered at me. I wondered what they saw. The ceiling began to move. I was being wheeled somewhere. I remember opening my eyes and watching a doctor sewing my mouth. I wanted to struggle, but I lay still. My head ached. When I opened my eyes again, there was only a nurse in the room, writing on a clipboard. I tried to sit up. She came over and steadied me. "Take it easy," she whispered. She read the fear in my eyes. "Do you know where you are?" she asked. I nodded. "You've been in and out since you got here. Your jaw is broken. You're going to be drinking a lot of milkshakes for the next couple of months. We're going to bandage your head wound. You have a concussion. The doctor's waiting for the x-rays to come down. He may want you to stay overnight for observation." My face and head felt huge and bloated. There was kindness in her smile. "One of the police officers will help you fill out a crime report." My eyes widened in fear. "It's required by law," she said. "You just lie there now. Don't try to get up. I'll be back in a while." I stood up as soon as she left. The room rotated around the axis of my feet. I had trouble focusing my eyes. My head wasn't working right. Soon they would find out I didn't have insurance. Momentarily, a cop would arrive. Every bit of information I gave him would be a lie. I was still a gender outlaw. Any encounters with the police might end up with me in their custody. I panicked. It was time to escape. I checked my wallet. I had more than enough for a cab ride home. The emergency room was so chaotic, no one noticed me leave. The icy blast of wind outside felt good against my swollen face, but it made my scalp ache. I stumbled to the corner of 14th Street and hailed a cab. The driver turned, "Where to, pal?" I couldn't answer. He frowned. "Where to, mister?" My hands moved in frustration. "You drunk or something?" "Ruth." I wanted to get to Ruth. I grimaced so he could see my gums were wired. "Holy shit," he said. I mimed writing. He handed me a pad and I wrote down my address. He watched me in the rearview mirror as he drove. "What happened?" I shrugged. "Oh yeah, you can't talk. I forgot." He pulled up in front of my building. "That'll be $3 for," he told me. I gave him a $5 and waved at him to keep it. All I could think of was Ruth's arms. But by the time I got to her door, I hesitated. Even though I could hear her in her apartment, I didn't knock. I quietly took out my own house keys. They were clotted with blood. I calmed my breathing, fearing I'd choke to death if I vomited. A moment after I'd closed my door, I heard a knock. I knew it must be Ruth. I held still and didn't move until she walked away and closed her door. Why was I suddenly so afraid to see her? Because I feared bringing so much need to her? What if I asked her for too much? What if she turned away from me? What if I lost her? I wanted to go to her, though. I wanted to kneel in front of her and ask her to hide me, to keep me safe. I wanted her love to protect me from harm's way. More than anything, I just wanted to be held, but I was so afraid to ask. My head hurt and hurt and hurt. I couldn't open my jaws. Panic burned like acid in my throat. I felt claustrophobic, trapped inside my head. My skull throbbed and the room tilted like the funhouse at Crystal Beach. For just a moment, I was more terrified not to ask for what I needed than I was to be rejected. I fumbled trying to open the lock on my door. I slammed it behind me and hurled myself against Ruth's door, pounding it with my fist. If she didn't answer fast, I'd lose my nerve. Ruth opened her door, wearing that old-fashioned apron. She pushed her very red hair out of her frightened eyes. My chin ached and trembled. I struggled to speak. She saw my gums laced with wire. Ruth reached out one hand to me, led me into her kitchen, sat me down. I tried to repeat two words over and over again, but she couldn't. She brought me a pad and pencil. I couldn't hold the pencil in my swollen right hand. She pulled an old baking sheet from the dish drain and opened a can of Crisco. Then Ruth smoothed a thick layer of lard over the aluminium and set it on the table in front of me. With my index finger, I wrote the two words I'd been repeating. "Help me." Ruth knelt in front of me and buried her face in my lap. She cried so bitterly I tried to comfort her, stroking her hair and smoothing the floral material covering her wide shoulders. "This is why I didn't want to let you in my life," she sobbed, "because I knew I'd have to look. When it's me, I don't have to see it. When I care about you, I have to look. I see it and I don't want to." Her words confirmed what I feared most. I'd asked for too much. I stood up slowly and staggered to the door. Ruth put her hand on the door. "Jess, sit down. Where are you going?" She wiped her eyes with the back of her hand. I looked at her calmly, hiding the crisis of rejection. "Honey," she stroked my cheek. "I'm so sorry. I just didn't want it to be you. Come on, honey. Please, come." Ruth guided me to her bedroom. I covered my eyes against the sunlight streaming in her window. She pulled the shades. Ruth laid me down on her bed. I could feel the embroidered edges of her pillowcase against my cheek. My head hurt even worse when I lay down. I sat up, unable to explain why. Ruth touched the back of my head. I winced in pain. She stared at her hand in horror. It was covered with blood. Jeff, she whispered, I'm afraid. My eyes narrowed in anticipation of another rejection. Ruth lifted my hand in both of hers and kissed each bruised knuckle. I wasn't afraid to die in her bed with my hand in hers. She gently pressed my head against her body. It hurt, but I needed her closeness. My voice dropped low like a whisper. I once read in an old drag magazine of time, long, long ago, when people like us were honoured. If I had the power, Jess, I'd take you back and leave you there with people who'd care for you as much as I do. I know you were safe, and you'd be loved. I tried to sit up. Lean against me, Jess. You need to rest. I moan as I tried to lay my head against her breastbone. Ruth propped me up with pillows. She curled up between my thighs and stroked my chest with her wide hand. Shh, she whispered. I know you're frightened too, but it's going to be all right. It's always the worst when they hurt my head. I'm always afraid I'll lose my thoughts, my memories. I'm scared I'll lose me. Is that how you're feeling? She wiped the tears from my cheeks. I closed my eyes. Try to stay awake, honey, she pleaded. Please, I'm afraid for you to fall asleep right now. I wanted to go away. I'll tell you stories, she smiled. I'll tell you where I grew up. Would you like that? I blinked back to consciousness and nodded. Ruth rested her cheek against my chest and squeezed me tight. Oh, Jess, I wish I could show you the vineyards. I wish you could smell the grapes in the fall air. Ruth looked up at me and smiled. Someday I'm going to make you grape pie. After my grandma Anne's and my mamma's, I'll make the best grape pie in the valley. Grape pie didn't sound very good to me, but it didn't matter much at that moment. Ruth mesmerized me with her voice. I wish I could show it all to you. How the hills change with the seasons. In the winter, my Uncle Dale could name every tree for me, just by the shape of its silhouette outlined against the sky. But it was the vines that brought out to discover spring. We might not have noticed the smell of the earth thawing if it hadn't been for the work that needed doing. The men trimmed the vines, and we tied them to the locust posts. The women all working together in the vineyards were the best time of my life, Jess. I know it was hard work lugging those heavy grape trays, but all I remember is talking and laughing together. All the stories seem to begin with the same sentence. Remember the time that... Ruth glanced up to make sure I was awake. When I was 8 or 9, my Uncle Dale tried to take me out with the men to prune the vines, but my mother said no. She and my aunt and my grandma took me to work with them. They already knew my nature. I stiffened as the pain grew inside my head. Ruth rubbed my chest until the hurt subsided. I remember my Uncle Dale told me, my mother, I needed a man around. My dad died when I was so young. Dale used to come by to take me hunting. Mostly we just walked in the woods. He taught me to respect Bear Hill. That's the birthplace of the Seneca Nation. The government cut a road right through the burial grounds there. Anyway, Dale seemed to get more and more upset about the way I was growing up. There certainly wasn't anything manly about me, and I think he felt it was his fault. One spring day, we were walking on Bear Hill. The clouds were moving fast, throwing shadows over the valley and the lake as they passed. Uncle Dale seemed so disgusted with me, I thought he'd stop taking me on those walks. At the top of the hill, I saw a man whose hair was long and chocolate brown, like muck. Someday I'll show you the land we call muck. It's very fertile and very beautiful. They stood there talking. Then Dale nodded towards me and said, I'm trying to teach the boy to be a man. His voice sounded like he'd already failed. I felt so ashamed standing there, the stranger hearing the disappointment in my uncle's voice at the same moment I did. But the man put his hand on my uncle's shoulder and he said, let the child be. After a minute, Dale hung his head and nodded. He looked at me different after that, like he was seeing me for the first time. Ruth cried softly against my stomach. I ran my fingers through her hair. I wanted him to love me so much, and after that he did. I knew he cared about me before, but I didn't think he'd been able to accept that I wasn't growing up to be a man. But after that day, we didn't pretend to hunt anymore. We just went for walks. He loved those hills more than any human being. I was so proud he'd take me up there with him. She reached for a Kleenex and blew her nose. Want to hear something funny? She smiled. Years later, I reminded him about the man we met on the hill, and Uncle Dale told me it never happened like that. He said it must have been one of the spirits of the Senecas who walked those hills. I don't know if it's really happened or not. I do know that something changed between me and Dale that day. I know it was real hard for him to admit. I rolled my head gently against the pillows until I found a place on my skull that didn't hurt. My eyelids fluttered. Jess, fight to stay awake, honey, please. Wake up, Jess. That's the last thing I heard her say before I lost consciousness. In the days that followed, I drifted in and out of awareness, bedroom with Ruth. Their hands felt reassuring on my body. Ruth propped me up while the woman cleaned a spot on my scalp that hurt real bad. When she was done, she wrapped the whole head in gauze. Ruth helped me sit up and urged me to drink through a straw. I saw my blood was everywhere, sponge print circles on the wall behind the bed, soak stains in Ruth's beautiful embroidered pillowcases. As the days passed, I could hear the sound of Ruth's weeping replace the steady hum of her sewing machine. Even in the state of semi-consciousness, I knew I asked too much of Ruth this time. My blood was all over her life and the stains weren't going to scrub out. One morning I felt her lips on my forehead and opened my eyes. I forgot about my jaw and tried to speak. When I couldn't, I grabbed my face. She put her hands over mine. "It's okay, honey. You're getting better. Look at me. Let me see your eyes." She held my head between her hands as though it was a crystal ball. When I saw her expression, I wondered what had made me think I had to ask for her love. She dropped her eyes. "I've done something terrible, Jess. I was just trying to help. I let myself in next door and found the name of the company where you work, check stubs, you keep on the kitchen table. I thought if I called you in sick, you might be able to keep your job. I told them you got mugged and you'd be out for a week or two. Jess, I referred to you as she. I wasn't thinking. They heard it. I'm so sorry. I know it means I lost that job for you." Ruth touched my face. "I know you must be really mad at me." I shook my head. "It was a mistake, that's all." I thought about Duffy, the union organizer, doing the same thing, and I forgave him in retrospect. I fluttered my hand to ask for something to write with. Ruth came back with a pen and paper. My right hand was stiff and sore, but the words I wrote were legible. The message life had given me another chance to deliver. Ruth read the words out loud. "Thank you for your love." And then we cried together. I visited the graphic arts employment agency in person and wrote down that I was looking for work. I started a new job the same night. That's when I realized I'd become a valuable typesetter. Christmas was a month and a half away, and the third shift could hardly handle the volume of work the ad agencies were sending over. I took all the overtime they offered. I wanted a chunk of money fast. At night, I lived inside the coding strings, my face illuminated by the ghostly light of the terminal. The code phrases became my poetry, the curves of type against space sang to me, the melody meant everything, the words meant very little. At dawn, I worked out of the gym, pausing only when the throbbing in my head frightened me. I moved my will to live down deeper into my body. Since my rage and frustration couldn't escape through my clamped jaws, I screamed through my muscles. I thought I might explode with rage. At first, working out of the gym reduced the pressure, but after a while, the frenzied workouts became part of it. I was a time bomb, ticking, ticking, moments away from detonation. I didn't sleep very much, just a few hours in the morning and late afternoon. I feared losing consciousness, afraid I'd never find my way back. Ruth seemed worried about how much time I spent away from the apartment. I could tell by the relief of her face every day when I knocked on her door to check in with her. "Where do you go?" she sighed as she poured me a protein shake. I could tell she didn't expect an answer. Restlessness drew me to Far Rockaway Beach on a cold December morning. As I walked along the shore, I thought about how fear and silence had welded my jaw shut for more of my life than I'd realized. I wondered if silence had killed Rocco. And the anonymous butler, a little bit at a time too. What would I say when I finally snipped the wires that held my jaws clamped? The lobster shift foreman handed me the last check I needed 2 days before the Christmas weekend. In the morning, I'd go to the check cashing office, flash my company card, and walk out with all the money I needed to buy the gift for Ruth. I snuck into the lunchroom without punching out and slipped between the two vending machines in the corner that formed my favourite hiding place at work, carefully leaning my head against the wall. The headaches were milder, but they still frightened me. I heard Marija and Karen, both typesetters, come into the lunchroom laughing. "You got change?" Marija asked. I sat very still, afraid of being discovered. Marija's hands always captured my attention. Some people drag their hands through life like heavy weights. Others speak with their hands, but Marija's hands were different. Although they communicated, they seemed to be carrying on an entirely separate conversation than the one she was verbally engaged in. When she talked with other typesetters, she laughed nervously and chewed her lip, but her hands were calm. While her words cut cruelly to the quick, her hands found the sore places on a co-worker's shoulder or neck. I imagine feeling those remarkable hands stroking my head, caressing my neck. "I'll tell you, it's creepy," Marija said, "the way he looks at me." "Who?" Karen asked. Marija sighed. "The guy who never talks, Jesse. I'm telling you, the way he stares at me creeps me out." Karen laughed. "Maybe he's got the hots for you." "Yeek," Marija said. "He looks at me like I'm a piece of meat or something." "He's harmless," Karen chuckled. "You don't know that," Marija countered. "He could be a psycho." Karen interrupted. "He's so effeminate, he's gotta be gay. I heard them leaving. I'm telling you," included. "He's the kind of guy you gotta watch out for." I could see Marija's hands gently rest on the small of Karen's back. I closed my eyes and waited until I was sure they were gone. Then I walked out of the shop, knowing I could never return. When I got home, I leaned the bathroom mirror up against the couch and found a pair of scissors and tweezers. I took a couple of long pulls of whiskey through a straw before I cut each wire that laced my gums shut. I pulled each segment out with a sure stroke, the way I pulled off old band-aids. Not fast, not slow, just steady. After I was sure I'd gotten the last piece of wire out of my gums, I rinsed my mouth with whiskey, and then drank the rest of it so I could sleep without remembering how Mirage's words had stripped me of my humanity. When I awoke, I walked up 34th Street, manoeuvring in the throng of shoppers like a warrior. I knew exactly what I was looking for. "The best sewing machine you have," I wrote on a piece of paper and handed it to the saleswoman. Then I realised my jaw wasn't wide shut anymore. Silence had become a habit. She led me to the display models. They all looked pretty much the same, except for one. I didn't sew, but I knew it was the right machine when she pointed to it. It glinted in the light like a motorcycle. The saleswoman talked to me about attachments and the endless things it could do. I smiled, not understanding a word. I could already see Ruth hunched over this magnificent machine, stitching her magic into fabric. As I paid for it in cash, I felt excitement, something I hadn't felt in a long time. A light snow fell as I lugged the machine back through the crowded streets and hailed a cab. As soon as I got home, I cleaned my apartment with a vengeance. But I was filthy. I took a long hot shower, letting the water soften my jaw so it didn't click each time I opened my mouth. I dried off and put a clean white t-shirt and khaki chinos. While I combed my hair, I caught sight of myself in the kitchen mirror. My eyes looked so sad I couldn't meet my own gaze. My face seemed much older than I'd remembered it. I ran my fingertips over the muscles that rippled across my shoulders and chest and arms. Suddenly, those long hours at the gym seemed to be proof of my will to live. I'd sent myself a gift, a memory of a body, of self. I shopped on Grand Street for handmade Chinese wrapping paper. I pointed to what I needed. I still didn't speak. The first words I spoke were to Ruth. I knocked on her door on Christmas Eve. "Jess, where were you? I was scared silly. Come on in. Tanya and Esperanza are here." I didn't move. "Are you okay?" She looked worried. I moved my jaw slightly. "Ruth." Tears welled up in her eyes when she heard my voice. "Thank you," I told her. "Thank you for everything you've done for me." We pressed our foreheads together. I know it was an awful lot to ask. "Hush," she whispered. "Ruth, I love you." "Shh, I know." She held my face in her cupped hands. "I love you too, honey." Ruth pulled me in close against her body. We hugged as though we'd never let go. "Ooh, let me have some of that," Tanya said. "Come in here, boy." Ruth smiled and shook her head. "Jess is a B-girl," she told Tanya. I hadn't heard that word in many years. B-girl, the old code word femmes used in public to refer to butchers when they're afraid of being overheard. There was so much about Ruth I still didn't know. "Ooh, honey," Tanya looked at me up and down appreciatively. "I could swing for you, girl." Ruth introduced me to Esperanza. "Mucho gusto," Esperanza whispered in a voice as complicated as Ruth and mine. Esperanza blushed as I kissed her hand. "We're trimming the tree. You want to help us?" She handed me tinsel. I smiled shyly. "I never did this before." Esperanza frowned. "You never decorated a Christmas tree before?" I shook my head. "You didn't have Christmas when you were a child?" I shook my head again. "Too poor?" I laughed. My jaw clicked as I answered. "Too." Ruth offered me a cookie she'd just decorated. "It's still warm, so it's soft. It's gingerbread. Try it. Just a bite." I rediscovered taste. We're making cookies to take to friends who are stuck in hospital with AIDS. Up until that moment, I had felt as though the epidemic was taking place a million miles away from me. "Can I go with?" I asked. Ruth sighed heavily. "Yes, if you want to." Tanya offered me a mug. "This is Tanya's killer eggnog. If this don't give you the holiday spirit, nothing will." Ruth wiped her hands on her apron. "Take it easy with that stuff." Tanya made a face at her. "Don't listen to her. Just because she's a friend of Bill W's doesn't mean we all have to hang out with him." "We're going out to a drag club later tonight. You want to come?" Esperanza asked. I looked at Ruth. She smiled and shrugged. "I'll teach you to bump and grind on the dance floor, honey," Tanya said. I laughed. "I'll show you a thing or two on the dance floor." "Lord have mercy," Tanya found herself with a large hand. "Kill me now." Esperanza smiled. "I'll teach you an old slave dance, the merengue." I remembered Ruth's present. "I'll be right back," I said. When I lugged the heavy rectangular present into her living room, Ruth sat down heavily on the couch as though she'd been hit with bad news. "It's for you," I smiled. "Open it up, girl," Tanya urged, chewed her lip. "You shouldn't have." All my love was in my smile. "Oh, hush." She sighed, opened the paper carefully, folded it and put it aside. When Ruth took the cover off the sewing machine, she gasped. I could tell by the way her fingers trailed across the machine how happy it made her. "I'll make you a suit," she whispered. I beamed. "Really?" Ruth nodded and bit her knuckles. She stood up and walked over to the crated evergreen. "These are for you," she handed me two flat packages. The first was a book called Gay American History. My hands trembled as I leafed through the pages. Look, Ruth took the book from my hands and turned to the index. Remember I told you about what I read in a drag magazine, about how people like us used to be honoured? Look at this whole section about native societies. But wait, look at this. She flipped the pages. This whole part is about women like you who lived as men. Tears clouded my vision. Esperanza looked at the title and shook her head. I wish we weren't always lumped into gay. Hush, Ruth shook her head. She handed me a package wrapped in red tissue paper. Open this. Inside was a watercolour of a face filled with emotion, looking up at a host of stars. It was a beautiful face, a face I'd never seen before. It was my face. Let me see that, honey. Tanya reached for it. Oh, Ruth, that's nice. That looks just like him. Ruth, I chewed my lip. Do I really look like this? She nodded and smiled through her tears. When I thought you might die, I started to sketch your face. I wanted something more than my memories of you to remain. Your eyes were closed, but I could shut my own and remember your eyes changes in the light. Ruth sat down next to me on the couch. We put our arms around each other and rocked. Esperanza and Tanya sat on the floor near us. My chin ached and trembled. You know, I told them, I've been searching for you all for such a long time. I can't believe I finally found you. I squeezed Ruth tightly in my arms as we both cried. Esperanza rested her hand on my thigh. Do you know what my name means? I shook my head. No, but it sure is pretty. She smiled and looked at me with a sure, unwavering expression. Esperanza, she explained, it means hope.